Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to the Tolkien Road, episode 251. Greta, what's up?
Hey. Not much. What's up with you?
Not a whole lot. No. But on this episode, we are joined by very special guest, Carl Hostetter, editor of the forthcoming book, The Nature of Middle-earth, which collects a multitude of heretofore unreleased writings from J.R.R. Tolkien.
Ooh. Yay. That's gonna be good.
I am pretty psyched for this.
Same.
Before we get started, we'd like to give a double up air five to our patrons. All right, you ready for this, Greta?
Let's do it.
3, 2, 1. Whoops. There we go. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Andrew T., John R., and Ms. Anonymous. And a shout out to our newest patron, Matt W., and to Tom M., longtime patron, who has boosted his pledge.
Oh, so nice. Thank you.
Thank you,
guys.
Matt. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thanks to all of you.
Subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. If you are a 5-star fan of the Tolkien Road, you can really help us out by heading over to iTunes or your preferred source for the show and dropping us a rating and review. When you do that, it helps get the word out about the Tolkien Road, which then encourages us to keep on evering on.
Evering on. I like that.
Yeah.
It's good.
Right on. Mm-hmm. It's time for the weekly Tolkien Road Air 5 for all of those watching us on YouTube. All right. So to get the double up Air 5, you got to be a patron, but we'll just do the one up Air 5. YouTubers, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Whoops. All right. Remember, patronize to become a double up Air Fiver. All right. And then while you're at it over on YouTube, subscribe and click the notify bell for our channel as I'm ramping up the release pace over there. All right. We got to get into this.
Yeah. I think that's the most efficient we've ever done that intro.
Well, I didn't want to keep Carl waiting.
I know. Neither did I.
So he's being so patient
very,
over there.
Very patient. I'm excited to start the interview, so.
Let's get it going.
Yeah.
Late last year, HarperCollins announced The Nature of Middle-earth, a new volume of writings from J.R.R. Tolkien. While numerous works have been published under Tolkien's name since his death in 1973, including The Silmarillion, Unfinished Tales, and the entire History of Middle-earth series, this latest edition of posthumously published Middle-earth writings is the first to feature an editor other than his son, Christopher, who passed away at the beginning of 2020. On this episode, we are excited to be joined by the editor of The Nature of Middle-earth, Carl Hostetter. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
Carl is a computer scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, head of the International Elvish Linguistic Fellowship, and a specialist in Tolkien's invented languages. He is the editor of two scholarly journals of Tolkienian linguistics, the print journal Vinyar Tengvar, and the online journal Tengvestie. All right. I'm stopping in the middle of the bio here, Carl. Did I get the names right so far?
Almost.
Okay. Let's come back to that and correct me when we get a little further into the interview here. I'm doing my best. With Christopher Gilson, Arden Smith, and Patrick Wynn, he was commissioned by Christopher Tolkien in 1992 to edit and publish Tolkien's linguistic writings, chiefly in the print journals Parma, Eldalamberon, and Vinyar Tengvar. With Verlin Flieger, he edited the collection Tolkien's Legendarium, Essays on the History of Middle-earth, published in 2000. Most recently, he provided an opening essay, Inventing Elvish, to the catalog of the Bodleian Library's Tolkien Maker of Middle-earth exhibit, published in 2018. And his edition of Tolkien's late writings, The Nature of Middle-earth, will be published in September. So first off, Carl, what did I get wrong in the pronunciation?
No, we should have practiced that in advance. So W is not pronounced V in Quenya. So it's Vinyar Tengvar and Tengvestie.
Ah, so my attempt to be fancy, my attempt to be correct was actually incorrect. All right. So I overdid it a little bit, I guess. So that's interesting. I think I've been saying the W's as V's for a long time on this podcast. I have this ongoing like thing about, you know, after doing 250 episodes of this show that I frequently am, you know, I've been saying things wrong, certain things wrong for a long time. So people are always writing in and being like, actually it said this way. Of course I get conflicting information sometimes.
At times in the history of Quenya, the V and the W were interchanged. So.
See, I'm just old.
You knew that, so yeah.
Well, that's what I was gonna say. I'm just old school like that. So, I just prefer my Quenya a certain way. So
there you go.
Carl, I just have to say, wow! Congratulations on becoming the editor of an entire volume of Tolkien's writings. That just has to feel amazing.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a privilege, of course, It's also a little scary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know how people are going to, what they're going to make of it, and especially how I compare it to Christopher's mode of editing. But we shall see. In any event, it was a lot of work, but it was also very rewarding and a great honor.
Yeah. Well, you've been heavily involved in Tolkien studies for several decades, and I can only imagine, like, you know, the honor that you're feeling right now. I know I'd be humbled by it. We were recently surveying the History of Middle-earth series, and I noticed you were mentioned by Christopher in both volumes 11 and 12, both times in relation to linguistic issues. And so we know from your bio and from those mentions that you must, you know, have some expertise in Tolkien's languages. So, you know, tell us a little bit about how your interest began in Tolkien's languages, or if you want to go even back and tell us about your interest in Tolkien in general.
Sure. My interest in Tolkien began in 1978 when, as a going away present from a friend, I was given a set of The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, the Valentine paperback. And I had never heard of Tolkien or read him before that. But my friend had good reason to think I would really enjoy it, and he was right. And I've been reading Tolkien ever since. I think I read The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings back to back probably 5 or 6 times upon my first set of readings.
Wow.
And I was instantly intrigued by the runes in the Tengwar on the title page of The Lord of the Rings, and of course the runes on The Hobbit too, but they're a different kind of rune. And I'd always had kind of an interest in dead languages. I had some interest in Latin. And something in me just decided I had to figure out what those meant. And then of course the snippets of Elvish that you get throughout especially The Lord of the Rings, just greatly intrigued me. So I progressively read everything that was being published by and about Tolkien, and I did sort of my own private work on the languages. You gotta remember, at this time, this was before the internet, so it was very hard to become in touch with other people with similar interests. And I knew only one other person in my high school who had any interest in the languages whatsoever. But that eventually changed when I learned about the existence of the Tolkien Society in Britain, and I had got its address, so I immediately joined up and got their bulletin from which I learned that there was a Tolkien Society, Linguistic Society, and they published their own bulletin called Quetar, which means words. So I immediately, of course, got that. And then I learned from it not too long after about the existence of a U.S. counterpart known as the Elvish Linguistic Fellowship. So between all these connections, I started meeting other like-minded people, started corresponding with them. Eventually, I became the editor of Vinyar Tengwar, took it over from the original editor. And... now, keep in mind, at that point, I had no idea that I would ever be writing anything because I sort of thought it had all been done. I was really impressed by all the work that these other people had done before me, and I thought, oh, I've got nothing to add. Well, that definitely changed.
Sure, yeah.
I sort of fell in with one person in particular, Patrick Wynn, and I became very good friends. And so we started collaborating on writing essays and columns together for Vinyar Tengwar. And in the course of doing that, I also, because of my role as editor of Vinyar Tengwar, I would have to ask for permission to publish, you know, unpublished snippets that had been recovered mostly from Marquette archives. And that's how I got in touch with Christopher Tolkien. And that was the start of a long and wonderful correspondence. And so as a result of that, myself and Christopher Gilson, who was and is the editor of Parma El Bellambron, plus our close colleagues, Arden Smith, Patrick Wynn, and Bill Weldon, we met with Christopher Tolkien at the Centenary Conference in 1992. Hmm. It was then that he asked us if we would like to become the editors and publishers of his father's linguistic papers.
Wow.
Because he really liked the approach we took to it, the care we took in editing it. Hmm. And I also like to think the fact that we all try to write clearly without using a lot of jargon or specialist terminology. And I think he really appreciated that approach to the subject as well.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I having just done a several episodes doing a survey of the history of Middle Earth, I think that's one thing for me about Christopher's style that I found somewhat frustrating. For as much as I value those works, sometimes the nature of, I guess, his style felt like it could be a little bit roundabout for me. And so trying to figure out exactly what he was getting at, sometimes you have to kind of reread it a couple of times. So I guess I value the brevity and directness, and style. So I think that can be very helpful when you're trying to teach complicated concepts to people who are not quite as well versed in them as you may be.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially I think when it comes to languages specifically.
Yeah,
because it's such a knack, I think. Either you got it or you don't. Mm-hmm. And my dad is a linguist, and he's, he knows 12 different languages, I think. And I tried, I was at one point fluent in German, but other than that, I get it all mixed up. I mean, I just, so I think especially, there's Tolkien and then there's language within Tolkien. And I think even, that the brevity and the lack of jargon when trying to explain that can be a real asset for sure.
Absolutely.
So I speak only one language.
only one real language.
I know a great deal about a number of other languages, but I do not speak. I express I'm bisschen Deutsch.
Same.
I can speak a little bit of Japanese.
All right.
That's more than I know.
Otherwise, nothing.
Yeah. Well, you clearly know enough to have, because based on all the things that you've contributed to in the past, and can you write it? Can you pen it?
Yes.
Pen the Elvish? I should have been more specific. Elvish.
Time, I can cobble together sentences that probably are not too terribly off.
Yeah.
But of course, we can't ever really know because we don't have any native Elvish speakers. Mm-hmm. Tolkien is not around to give his thoughts anymore.
Yeah.
Well, so I think we kind of made our little sidebar there around about 1992, and so take us forward from there to, the next couple of decades, continued correspondence with Christopher, and then. How you got to the nature of Middle Earth.
Sure. Let's see. So as part of, he was sending us manuscripts in photocopy. Mm-hmm. We'd get a bundle every now and then over the course of years and years. And late in that process, one of the bundles that he sent was what he called late philological essays. They touched on the languages, and in many of these papers, the language was the point of departure, but they were very long and discursive essays that would start by elaborating on points of the language, but then branch out into philosophical matters, into matters of geography. And I really found this stuff fascinating. There's one essay in this bundle in particular called the Osanwe Kenta. Mm-hmm. And that means an essay on communication of thought. So it's about telepathy, not just amongst elves and the Valar, but also amongst, any incarnate person has this capability, whether they can realize it or be effective at it is another matter.
Wow.
But this led him to a discussion of the freedom of minds,
Mm-hmm.
Can they be forced open? Can somebody force their way into your mind to read it? And so it started touching on matters of both natural law and physical law.
Wow. And
it ends with, I'm not going to give it away. This has been published already, but only in Vinyar Tengwar.
Mm-hmm.
It ends with just one of the most powerful sentences, powerful paragraphs that I think Tolkien ever wrote. And so I immediately knew I had to publish this.
Yeah.
Now, that wasn't a sense, this was about 25 years ago now, that wasn't a sense my first step on the book, what would become the book, The Nature of Middle-earth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I published a number of similarly philosophical essays from that bundle in Vinyar Tengwar, which, by the way, we just abbreviate as VT. So I think I'll do that from now on.
Okay.
Another one essay from that bundle is called The Rivers and Beacon Hills of Gondor. And it's all about the names of rivers and the names of the Beacon Hills, and it touches on all kinds of geographical matters.
Hmm.
So I published that in VT as well. So knowing of my interest in that sort of thing, particularly the philosophical aspects of matters, quite a few years later, Christopher Tolkien asked me to help a French scholar, Michael DeVoe, edit some similarly late writings on Elvish reincarnation, which had not been published. So I did that. I assisted DeVoe with that, and some years later it was published in a French journal. The English text with French translation and French commentary.
Hmm.
But again, these sorts of specialist journals are not something that a lot of people know about.
No.
Sometimes, at least, it used to be rather difficult to get a hold of some of these, particularly in my case, these foreign journals.
Mm-hmm.
So, somewhat later on, still, after Christopher had finished what he wanted to do with his father's papers for the History of Middle-earth, he wrote to me and said, I've got this final bundle of materials that I call Time and Aging, the Time and Aging file. I don't know what to do with it. Would you like to see it? And I said, yes.
Right.
So he sent it to me. And this was...
I'm sorry, I gotta say something real quick, Carl.
Sure.
It's like it was like in Ghostbusters, they had that line where it's like, if someone asks you or God, you say yes. If Christopher Tolkien asked you if you want to see some of his father's unpublished papers, you say yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So as I was saying, there's a preview out just today of my book, and which if you I don't know if you have a chance to put a link up or anything like that.
I will definitely link to the preview. I don't have a way. I could do a screen share, I suppose. Are you thinking of me doing it live right now on the cast?
Whatever you think is best.
Yeah, let me see if I can pull that off. I'm not sure if it'll work to allow me to do both that and.
Right.
Let me try to figure it out here. Keep going though.
Okay, so you can actually get a taste of the Time and Aging material. Right now, if you wish. In addition to that large collection of manuscript material, and thinking about the other essays that I've already mentioned from the late philological essays, together with other matters of similar nature regarding philosophical matters or matters of the flora and fauna, matters of things like spirit. So thinking about all the, and that material I was thinking specifically of that had been published in conjunction with the linguistic papers in primarily Parma El Galambaron. I realized that, and in addition to a lot of material that I had collected myself from the two main archives that until now unpublished, I started to see how I could form a book out of this seemingly quite disparate material.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I did that, the way I unified it, is that I settled almost immediately on the title, The Nature of Middle Earth.
Hmm.
Now, in English, nature has two chief senses.
Mm-hmm.
It, nature can refer to flora and fauna, animals, plants, you know. That's one sense of nature. Another sense is the innate quality or characteristic of things, our human nature, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And those two senses really cover the range of material that's in this book.
Awesome.
So I'm really pleased with myself that I was able to take advantage of an ambiguous term for this title. And so I wrote to Christopher, explained my idea to him, and he gave me his tentative approval to proceed with that plan. And then over time, I developed a proposal for the book to send to the publisher, HarperCollins, which had a selection of materials that I had already edited at that time, as well as a description of my plan for the book and, you know, what it would be about. And they were very happy. They got the approval of the Tolkien estate, including Christopher Tolkien, who was still alive at that time, to proceed with the book. And I'm happy to say that Christopher actually got to see a good chunk of the material for the book, as well as understand the structure of the book, my plan for it, before he passed away.
That's awesome.
That's so good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So good to hear.
Yeah.
So, first off, can you see, am I screen sharing successfully with you? Can you see?
Yes, I see the cover.
Okay, yeah.
Which is beautiful.
It is beautiful. Yeah, and we need to talk about the cover too, in addition to everything else.
Sure.
And then the second question, I think I completely forgot.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
When did you get the final approval for the book?
Yes.
Was that it?
That's what I was going to ask, yeah.
Was that telepathy? That may have been telepathy.
I'm not quite sure. It was maybe 3 years ago.
Okay.
Where their proposal was accepted.
Gotcha. Okay.
Around then.
And that's when you started kind of really in earnest putting it together and...
Yes. Yeah, that's when I really sat down and started editing all the material that I wanted to include in the book, but hadn't already edited.
Gotcha.
Hey there, fellow travelers. If you've made it this far on your journey down the Tolkien Road, you take Tolkien and Middle Earth as seriously as we do. That being the case, we want to invite you to join the Tolkien Road community over on Patreon. You've certainly heard us give shoutouts to our patrons before, but that's not the only benefit our patrons receive. Other benefits include patron-only episodes, annual gifts, personalized video greetings from John and Greta, early access to new episodes, free copies of my books Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture, and more. Oh yeah, and just in case you find ads like this a bit annoying, Tolkien Road episodes are ad-free on Patreon. That's right. Not only do you get the latest episodes of the Tolkien Road early on Patreon, but you get them commercial-free as well. Most importantly, your monetary support makes it possible for the Tolkien Road to keep on evering on. The truth is, it takes time and money to create this podcast, and every dollar helps us on our quest to make the Tolkien Road something Tolkien himself would be proud of. And by the way, if you're enjoying this interview with Carl Hostetter, be sure to check out our patron-only bonus conversation, where Carl shares his views on Peter Jackson's films, Lord of the Rings on Prime, Tolkien studies, and the ever-controversial question of Tolkien and religion. So what are you waiting for? Head on over to patreon.com/Tolkien Road for more info. Once again, that's patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Now, back to the show.
I can't imagine, like, the undertaking.
Yeah, I know.
Because that's, you know, when I was tempted to get frustrated when we were doing the History of Middle Earth series, just a lot, you know, especially as with the commentary and, you know, just kind of how confusing some of it was, I would just had to stop myself and be like, but God bless Christopher for taking this on. Because I can't even imagine. Just, I know that JRR was not the most organized individual. I get that feeling. Because he would just scribble in random places.
Tolkien very much did not want to throw away paper that could be reused for another purpose. So it's not infrequent to find he's working on a manuscript. He strikes out one side of a page and flips it over and starts, you know, continuing on the other side of the page. Or he's got scrap paper from an earlier work that he's decided he is no longer important. And he'll just grab random pages from that and start using the back of the sheets for drafting.
So just putting it all in order.
Or just bored with grading exams.
Right, exactly.
Turn it over.
Mm-hmm. And really, when you see the edited text, that's only about half the story, because the other half is reading Tolkien's handwriting, which at times is incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. And that actually, by the way, is another reason why he approached me and my colleagues with the linguistic paper project. It's because we'd gotten a lot of experience at reading Tolkien's handwriting. Mm-hmm. We've gotten much better since those early days, I can tell you. But even then, you know, we had gotten pretty good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So. That is probably half the battle.
I'd imagine. I've seen just a little bit of his handwriting, you know, from various facsimiles in the books, and that is no small feat.
Yeah.
So, Carl, did you want to look at the preview here, or take us to something in particular in the preview?
Oh, I really was just going to say to anybody who wanted to get a taste for the book, they could go to that link and then peruse it. Whatever you would like to do.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure, so I went ahead and brought it up. But while we've got it open, though, one of the things I absolutely wanted to ask you about was the cover.
Same.
Sure.
So it is such a beautiful image, and I have an idea of what it is, but I don't want to say. I wanted to just hear it from you. Tell us a little bit about this image and why you chose it.
So. I chose it because I thought it was the best of the three that were offered me.
Oh, there was only three. Only three choices. Yeah. Okay.
This is by Ted Daysmith. It's from a larger painting. I believe the title is Kalakirda, which is the pass of light in Valinor, through which the light of the two trees shines out onto the water.
Hmm.
And the shores there you see would be the mansions of the Teleri along the shore. There's a little bit of an irony here, because this is actually really already well known. All of the material that's in this book, or nearly all of it, is from the time when Tolkien had decided that the sun and the moon were co-evil with the earth, that there had never been a time where Middle-earth was just all in darkness. The elves awoke. Truly, it's true they awoke under the stars, but it was just night, and then the next day the sun would rise.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, there never was a time in the materials that are included in my book where there was a need for any such thing as the passive Kalakirda.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah, but don't tell anybody.
I won't. Be our secret, Carl. It's our secret.
I guess that's the nature of working with the writings of someone like J.R.R. Tolkien, where he was, you know, over the course of his lifetime, figuring all these details out, right? You know, just constantly kind of shifting his mind, shifting his opinion on all these things. It's a beautiful image regardless. I really love it. It's very, very striking to me. It reminds me somewhat of my first copy of the Silmarillion, which features I'm not sure who the painting's by, but it's a illustration of the awakening of the elves. That's kind of reminds me of the same kind of dark nighttime, under the stars, kind of feel for it. So,
I think it works really well too, that when you were talking about kind of the ambiguity of the term nature, having kind of those two different meanings, that there's kind of the juxtaposition on the cover too of dark and light, and you know, have the two different possibilities, and that just hit me. So
yeah, it's
beautiful.
I love the title. Mm-hmm. I I kind of sensed where you were going with the title, you know, from the moment I heard it, before we even had our first conversation. And I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, this is going to be about both the nature and the nature, the metaphysic, you know, exactly. You know, these bigger issues, which is just, mm-hmm. is a, you know, for Tolkien fans, people who have gone deep into the lore. I mean, I just can only imagine like the treasure trove that this is going to be. So many questions. I've just looking at the preview today, all the content in there that deals with like the, you know, the issue of time, especially in the First Age and pre-First Age periods, the aging of elves, mm-hmm. Those sorts of questions. So fascinating. And by the way, I think, where can we get Tingwar, am I saying it right or am I getting it backwards?
Vinyar Tengwar, VT.
VT.
Yes.
So you can order them as print on demand collected volumes from Amazon.
Okay.
In a number of Amazon stores around the world.
Okay.
And I keep them as cheap as possible. So.
Thank you.
They're fairly inexpensive.
Wonderful.
And well worth it, I would say.
Yeah. Well, just hearing that about that essay, I had no idea that the essay that you mentioned previously, mm-hmm. Existed. So, you know, that's a big reason for me to want to, you know, grab that, at least that volume itself. And, you know, I'm sure I'll want to get the rest of them once I've seen that one. So,
I will say this though. I mean, the material from VT that is, lends itself more to a more general audience is all included in the nature of Middle-earth.
That, so, I was just going to ask that, how much overlap there might be. So it's good to know.
So, yes.
Very cool. Including that paragraph that you mentioned.
Oh, yes.
Okay, good.
One more thing I'd say about that preview is, it was apparently generated from the ebook version. And so, oh. It omits all of the footnotes, which are Tolkien's, mm-hmm. and all of the endnotes, which is my editorial commentary. So the actual character of the book is going to be a little different from what you see in that preview.
So that's not going to be
a case.
That won't be included in the ebook, the footnotes and the endnotes.
It will be, but I think it looks like they're going to be put in as links.
Yeah, usually what they do with the Kindle ebooks is they like it link. It's like a hyperlink. It's got the number and it's a hyperlink, and you click. It actually works pretty well now, where you click it and then you just, once you go to the footnote and you've read it, you just click the number again.
That's,
and it takes,
right.
you back to where you were. So,
right.
And in some of the bigger readers, it like pulls up in the bottom and everything. It's kind of, you know, it works pretty well. Well, that's good to know. There's an abundance of footnotes and endnotes that, mm-hmm. For this kind of stuff. That's always. You know, some of the best stuff's always in yeah. those. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, so going back to the language question, you know, so the website that you, you know, that you published, and that I kind of guess is kind of a center of your work, has been a center of your work for a long time, is elvish.org.
Correct.
So, here's my question, and I kind of know the answer to this, but I want to hear you explain it, and I think a lot of people would benefit from this. Can one simply learn Tolkien's languages? Like Boromir, like, one does not simply learn Tolkien's languages.
If you mean learn in the sense of learn to speak, I would say a short answer is no.
Okay.
Now, the reason for that is there's a lot of points of grammar about which Tolkien either wrote too little or too much. His language has changed across his life every bit as much as the Legendarium did, perhaps more so. So for example, for a long time, we didn't have a complete paradigm of the personal pronouns in either Quenya or Sindarin. Well, now we have a number of them to choose from. So, you know, if you really want to turn it into a spoken language, you all have to agree on what system you're going to use.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a bit of vocabulary, but given the nature of what Tolkien was doing with the languages, a lot of them are more geared towards poetic concepts, certainly the natural world. but you're not going to find a lot of sort of what we as English speakers consider to be workaday vocabulary. So if you want to be able to hold a casual conversation about the nightly news, you're going to have to invent a lot of stuff. And it's, that's very hard to do, of course, on the fly. You can certainly learn a great deal about Tolkien's languages. But in terms of learning to speak them, I would have to say no, unless it's highly qualified, as if you get enough people together and they agree on a common set of grammar rules and vocabulary and can make up vocabulary, you could make a spoken language out of, based on Tolkien's language, but it still would not be Tolkien's languages.
That makes sense. That also explains why you only know one language, because if it was possible to learn Elvish, you would know it and speak it.
Well, I would say too, I've been using Elvish as a shorthand here, because there are in fact two main Elvish languages,
right?
And then there's sketches of a bunch of others as well. But for this purpose, Elvish is good enough.
Right. It's also an easier domain for the website elvish.org. Sure.
It's kind of all inclusive.
That website is sorely out of date, but I just haven't had the time to sit down and redesign it. So it's going to look very 1990s, early 2000 design, but
I love it. That just shows that you're for real, right? You've been doing this, you've been at this a long time.
So. I'm old school.
You are, right. Exactly. Just like you.
That's right. That's
the
right.
The way you speak Elvish. Perfect.
Yeah. All right. Let's see here. So, I'm going to just flip through the preview a little bit here, and because we've got this preview as of today, it's such a nice thing that this preview came in.
That's perfect timing.
And just read some of it. I'm going to let you talk. Carl, you can say whatever you want to say along the way about the general contents of The Nature of Middle Earth. But what we have here, I'm just going to read the headers for our viewers and our listeners. So this is, the preview begins part one, Time and Aging. The first section is the Valian Year. Second section is Valinorian Time Divisions. The third section is Of Time and Arda. The fourth is Time Scales. The fifth is Natural Youth and Growth of the Quendi. That's a very interesting one I want to read soon. And I have looked at it. It's got some very interesting little tidbits just jumping out. I love it when I read these things, when I see essays like this and they've got like tables in them, and I'm like, okay, cool. I'm going to be able to conceptualize this pretty well. Section six, the awakening of the Quendi. Let's see. Seven is the March of the Quendi. And so a lot of this, just has to do with breaking down the different timetables, Tolkien's writings on the timetables of these big events, especially from the First Age and even predating the First Age.
Right. So I can talk about that a little bit, if you like. So the first text, I call it chapter, the first chapter of part one, shows, and it's made plain in the preview, even though they stripped out my editorial commentary, that Tolkien decided at around 1957 that the Valian year, instead of being 10 years of the sun as prior to that, is 144 years. So the effect of that is that he tremendously increased the length of time that the tale of years that are told in terms of Valian years took.
Yeah.
And if you stop and think about that, that has a lot of implications for the rate of population growth for the elves. Because it takes them a much greater time just to get to the shores of Beleriand, and then all the events that occur before they return to Beleriand. And also even in, I guess, a little indirectly affects, you know, the rate at which they age or the implications mm-hmm. for this hugely increased time span mm-hmm. on that. And so a lot of what's in the time and aging file, and this is clearly reflected in the preview as well, is him working out the implications and details and trying on different schemes, seeing what populations some, you know, certain assumptions generated, seeing if it was realistic. Is it too much? Is it too few? Greta, you'll appreciate this in particular. He starts out saying that elves gestate in the womb for 9 sun years.
Wow.
This eventually goes down to 1, and it appears that he ended up with 3.
Wow.
Merely 3 years.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Yeah,
very interesting.
You need to take a few deep breaths.
I know. I'm like starting to hyperventilate a little bit here. That's just one of the things we just love about Tolkien, right? I mean, I was trying to figure out, I wonder why in the first place, like, why go from 10 to 144? I mean, why make that change? And then, you know, to go from such a nice round, like, even number, like 10. I mean, 144 is an even number too, but not, you know what I'm trying to say. Like, 10 is just kind of a, you know, a nice number. And then 144, which is the square root of 12 is the, you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. It's 12 square.
I was going to say, it's not the square root. So anyway, I was just, you know, as
you'll see again, even from the preview, that there's what could be called a duodecimal scheme throughout Tolkien's calculations,
mm-hmm.
Pertaining not just to chronology, but also to elvish life cycles and spans.
Interesting. Okay.
For whatever reason, 12 became a very important number to him for those purposes.
Gotcha.
And I will say this too. There's a stage between when it was 10 years and when it's 144 where it was actually like 9.528 or something like that.
I think I remember that from the history of Middle Earth. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Good.
I cite the relevant information about what preceded this in my foreword, or in particular in the introduction to that part, which also is not included in the preview.
I mean, and this is just what we love about Tolkien, though. Like, it's, you know, it is the sense that he had that, like, an outside person who's not familiar with him would think, like, oh, he's just idiosyncratic. And true, he is idiosyncratic, but he was doing this stuff not, like, in some random fashion, like, oh, no, this feels better to me. He had like he was discovering it along the way, right? It was mm-hmm. he was uncovering all of this, like it was a thing out there that didn't just reside in his imagination, that it was something that he was studying and trying to put down and record and determine, right? That these were mysteries he was discovering alongside of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Something really beautiful about that.
It really is. Mm-hmm. It really is. Hey there, fellow Tolkienites. Since you happen to be listening to this podcast, I thought you'd be excited to hear that my books Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture are now available on Audible. Tolkien's Requiem is an exploration of the First Age story of Beren and Lúthien, as found in The Silmarillion. In Tolkien's Requiem, I explore how the story is rooted in Tolkien's own life, and the important role it plays in the Middle-earth legendarium. One reader called it a gift to the world, and another said, I wish I'd been able to read Tolkien's Requiem years ago. Tolkien's Overture explores Ainur Lendile, the music of the Ainur, which is the Middle-earth creation story. In Tolkien's Overture, I conduct a close reading of the text as found in the Silmarillion, and proceed to unpack the incredible role that music plays in the legends and lives of Middle-earth. One reader called it an excellent book, a critical and thoughtful deep dive into Ainur Lendile. Both books have been recently re-recorded in order to meet professional audiobook standards. Not only are both books available in audiobook format via Audible, but in signed paperback and Kindle as well. To learn more about Tolkien's Requiem, visit tolkiensrequiem.com. To learn more about Tolkien's Overture, visit tolkiensoverture.com.
or just go to tolkienroad.com/books to see them both at once. Seriously, though, I'm really proud of both of these books, and I know that you, like so many others, will enjoy them. So do yourself a favor and check them out. TolkienRoad.com/books. And now, back to the show.
We have calculations on, like basically the age equivalent, like the human age equivalents of certain elvish figures. So, like Elrond. So it says he was born 58 sun years before the end of the First Age and the overthrow of Morgoth, but he was born in Middle-earth and so inherited from the beginning the rate 100 to 1. And he lived then through the Second Age of Middle-earth, 3,441 years. He wedded Celebrion in the Third Age, 100, it is said, and left Middle-earth at the end of the Third Age. So you do some math here and kind of explain, and like it different at these different kind of turning points in his life, like what like the man age equivalent, you know, would have been for him and then for other figures as well. So when he was at the end of the Third Age, he was then in human terms just over 65 and still in full vigor. Is kind of the math, the resulting math from all of that. Now, just so I'm clear, this is math that you did, or based on the previous stuff that Tolkien had laid out, or is this actually Tolkien himself explaining this?
Oh, this is all Tolkien's math.
Okay. Okay.
Which was surprising to me that how adept he is at mathematics. Remember, this is an age before electronic calculators were at all affordable. Mm.
Sure.
Most of this writing is circa 1959. In the preview, I allude to the fact that he made this calculation of a certain ratio, and I don't know how or why, but he calculated it out to around an estimated 360 decimal places.
Decimal places?
Decimal. In other words, digits after the decimal.
360.
Point. Around 360. I didn't actually count. I just did an estimate. And he noticed that there was a repeating pattern in the digits, and he highlighted that. So,
wow.
I did see, that was at the end of one of these sections here, that he speaks about. He lays out different, like different units of time.
Yeah,
all the way down to seconds, and
all that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
and again, they're all based on subdivisions of 12.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes. Which 144 is 12 squared?
That's right.
Yes.
Gotcha.
I got
good
it
job.
That time. I was like, I know it's squares.
It's also a gross.
A gross? What does that mean?
That's like a it's like an English unit, right? Or like
yeah, but I think it's used in what? Fellowship of the Ring, right?
Oh.
One gross. That's right.
Or at the party, yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody takes offense to the use of it, I think.
Oh.
Correctly?
Sounds about right. For sure. For sure.
Interesting.
A number of the changes that Tolkien made to the Tale of Years after the first edition, you will see in these writings where he, you know, came up with the need and the rationale to do so.
Oh, okay.
That's really what drove all that.
And okay. So it was not just flippant like I like this number better than this number. Like it was clearly much more to it than that.
That's right.
Which is not surprising to any of us. Yeah.
Yeah, just to give a little flavor, you know, I'm just flipping through this preview here, so this jumped out to me. Thus, the Quendi did not live slowly, moving ponderously like tortoises while time flickers past them in their sluggish thoughts. Indeed, they move and think swifter than men and achieve more than a man in any given length of time. But they have a far greater native vitality and energy to draw upon, so that it takes and will take a very great length of time to expend it. And that's really interesting because I feel like sometimes they can give an impression and sometimes like certain depictions of them that elves do kind of move in this, you know, slow fashion. But it's interesting to see Tolkien address that directly and say, no, they don't live slowly at all. Right. They're much more full of life than the average man would be. And, they just, it's a different, almost a different mode of existence, you know, because of the length of their time, the length of their lives.
So Tolkien makes it plain, and I think again, even in just this preview, that he considered elves to be in essence unfallen men.
Mm-hmm.
They had the complete mastery of their body. Their souls had complete mastery of their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which you would guess that the unfallen humans did too, to start with.
It just looks to me, just from this preview alone, that we are going to get so many answers from this book. Mm-hmm. Probably a lot of questions too, because that's how typically things work with Tolkien.
And
I think that's just true of like knowledge in general. Like once you answer some, you know, solve some mystery, there's always like, it leads to more questions. But that's part of the fun, you know, of all of this. But it really does look like there's going to be lots of maybe questions we've had for a long time about what Tolkien thought on a certain subject that finally we're going to get, we're going to get our hands on these answers, and then we're going to have a million more questions
and that's,
as a result.
That's a good way to put it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that kind of your experience in going through all of these writings? Did you have many questions answered?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm certainly not all of them. I can't tell you, for example, whether or not Balrogs had wings, not based on anything in this book.
Darn.
But there are a few things that will be settled, or at least we have an answer from Tolkien. It may not have been his only thought, you know, for all time, but mm-hmm. at least he wrote down some things in this one place, you know, so at least mm-hmm. you have some evidence there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I remember we did at least one episode, I remember, focused on the elves at one point, and I remember we had all kinds of questions about their aging and why they never had many kids and all the things. And I mean, just based on that preview, it looks like we got a lot of those answers already. So.
Yeah,
that's exciting.
Yeah, there was a there was a lot of that in the later volumes of the History of Middle Earth, where he kind of dove into those sorts of questions.
This book will really appeal to people who loved Unfinished Tales and or Morgoth's Learning, Volume 10 of the History of Middle Earth. It's very much of that nature in its scope.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about the late writings, right? We're talking about the post Lord of the Rings, you know, when he was still hopeful to maybe have the Silmarillion published in his lifetime and trying to figure out, you know, all of the answers that he felt like he needed, all the answers to all the questions he needed to address. Mm-hmm. Going back to the mind reading thing that we talked about towards the beginning of this episode, I have to, There was an episode of another podcast called Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yes.
I think we've maybe discussed that podcast, discussed Jimmy Akin before. But it was an episode about mind reading and certain experiments that have been done, you know, over the years, certain programs I think that the CIA ran. And it was so interesting to hear some of these things and some of the crazy things that people were able to accomplish using telepathy, supposedly. And one of the ways they explained it on that episode, as I was listening to it, was that it is this sense that all people actually have. It's just some of us are more in tune with it and some of us are less in tune with it. Just like, you know, perhaps a dog, right, can hear much further and in much, you know, more detail than a human being can, because they just have a stronger sense of hearing. So anyway, that just popped into my mind, you know, as you were talking about Tolkien's own thoughts there, but of course now I've got to get that. So that's why I've got to get this copy of VT in order to see Tolkien's full thoughts on that question. Cause I love where his mind was going. It seems to have been going from what you said.
Mm-hmm.
You notice you said popped into your mind. That's, I see what you did.
Oh,
wow.
Are you doing some mind control stuff on me, Carl? Come on. Well, I also just found that's so fascinating, because within Tolkien's own universe, you know, there is that sense of that Sauron is manipulating the minds of people who come into contact or in proximity with the ring, with the Palantiri, that there are those sorts of things going on, you know, that it's never made explicit, even in the sense of, you know, Shelob's lair, right? When Sam is there in Shelob's lair and he just has this inspiration, you know, to cry out to Devarta,
right?
You know, these beautiful scenes like that, you know, that that make me recall this. So I, anyway, if that's a sense, you know, between the time, you know, the issues of the nature of elves and the nature of time in Valinor, you know, mind reading, telepathy, if these are the kinds of questions that we're going to get answered in this book, oh my gosh, it just seems like it's going to be an incredible treasure chest for Tolkien fans.
Yeah, for sure.
I just have to say, like, before I've even read it, Carl, thank you for, you know, for undertaking this and for saying yes to Christopher when he was like, do you want some of my father's papers? I'm sure that was a real hard thing to do.
I was going
to
say, did you have to think about that, like, at all?
Yeah, for about a nanosecond.
Yeah. That sounds about right.
Wow. All right. Well, so a couple of things. So I think we're gonna wrap up the episode right here. We're gonna have you back on very soon, Christopher, once we can talk about the full book. Carl. Yeah.
Carl.
Sorry.
I think
I'm
he's
so
okay.
Sorry.
Carl.
You're okay with being called Christopher, I'm sure.
I don't
Carl, is it okay if I call you Chris?
Yeah, sure.
Sorry. Have I done that already? I was afraid I've done
you
that
haven't.
Already.
I don't think so.
I don't think
okay,
you have.
Good. All right. So we're just talking about Carl. Christopher. Carl.
Carl.
Okay. Have you back on soon, Carl, to talk about the nature of Middle Earth once it's out and we can talk about the full, you know, the full scope of the book.
I look forward to that.
And so tell us, the book comes out, I believe it's September 2nd.
Yes.
Okay. And it'll be available. So we know it'll be available in hardback, ebook. Will there be an audio version of it? Is there...
I don't think this kind of book lends itself to that. I mean, look at the preview.
I don't know.
But, you know, maybe selections from it. I've learned that the author is often the last person to know. I did not know there was going to be a deluxe edition until somebody else, you know, found a reference to it.
Isn't that the best, right? Here it is, the work of, you know, this work of your hands, and then it's just somebody else's project at this point, as far as getting it out there for all the masses to see.
That's right. There, I do know there will be some translations too.
Excellent. Oh, neat.
But again, a number of those I found out just because I happened to see the translators say so.
Yeah.
So.
Gotcha. It's funny how that happens.
Well, September 2nd, it's already available for pre-order. I've already pre-ordered my own copy, everybody. So make sure you go pre-order your copy so that you can open it up and just dive into all of the amazing stuff from Tolkien that's going to be in here. I just can't wait to read it. So, and hey, by the way, we are going to stop after this episode. We're going to switch over and do a patron-only episode with Carl. So that's going to be available. So if you're listening to this interview and you want to hear more from Carl, pop on over to our Patreon page to learn more about how you can get access to that interview. So we're going to be talking about some things like Carl's thoughts on the Peter Jackson films, the importance of Tolkien scholarship, and the upcoming Amazon TV production, and find out what Carl, any opinions Carl may have on that so far. So. We're looking forward to that and hope you'll join us over on Patreon.
For sure. I think it's probably also fair to say that we're going to be doing some podcast episodes focused on sections.
Oh, yeah.
From the book. So,
yeah.
Good.
Carl, I hope you've enjoyed this, because I'm just like, I probably want to have you back on more than just one other time to talk about the book eventually.
Oh,
so.
I absolutely enjoyed myself immensely. This is actually the first time I've done any sort of video podcast. So hopefully it went well.
I thought it was fantastic. You seemed like a pro. I'm shocked that this was your first rodeo with video podcasting.
Absolutely. No, it was great. And, you know, hopefully as you do more, which I'm sure you'll be doing, not just with us, but with others, you know, this has helped you, maybe be a nice little trial run for you and, you know, get used to it a little bit. So, lots of people are going to want to hear from you for sure. So,
Definitely. Definitely.
All right, Carl. Well, thank you so much.
Yes.
And,
thank you.
Stick around for our Patreon episode here soon. Speaking of Patreon, we're going to shout out to our, to some of our amazing patrons, especially the following: Andrew T,
John R,
Ms. Anonymous,
Caitlin of T with Tolkien,
Shannon S,
Brian O,
Emilio P,
Zeke F,
James A,
James L,
Chris L,
Chuck F,
Asya V,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D,
Eric S,
Joey S,
Eric B,
Johanna T,
Mike M,
Robert H,
Paul D,
Julia,
and Wurtie.
As well as those celebrating their Patreon anniversary in August, Tom M,
Jonathan L,
Henry B,
Austin B,
and Caitlin H.
Thank you guys.
Thank you all so much. Thanks again, Carl, and thanks for sitting through our listing of patrons.
Yes.
My pleasure.
We will talk to y'all next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.